This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Dr. Kevin Anderson is a professor of energy and climate change at the University of Manchester in the UK. He's also deputy director of the Tyndall Centre, a multi-university project for the study of climate change. Kevin has advised the UK government and the European Union. Kevin Anderson, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate your time. Let's get to some of the many questions about the reality of climate change and the human predicament. It seems that climate impacts expected decades from now are arriving much sooner. There's a long list from disappearing sea ice to melting in Antarctica. What surprises you?
Well, firstly, I think as scientists, we have to be very careful in differentiating between what appears to be the case, if you like, anecdote and the actual statistical evidence. So some things that we're fairly clear about here from the statistics, from the science, are the loss of Arctic ice and indeed the West Peninsula in Antarctica. So we can identify these things, and we're very confident these are a consequence of human emissions of greenhouse gases. When it comes to some of the other issues and the recent typhoon Pam or Haiyan, we have to be very careful there to say that these are climate change events. We cannot say that at the moment. All we can say is that these are consistent with what we would expect to see from the climate models. As scientists, we have to embed everything that we say in the actual science. So it's easy for the skeptics, if you like, to counter with quite unscientific statements. As for us as scientists, we have to be much more cautious in the language that we use. So there are certain impacts that we're seeing, such as the sea level rise and some of the loss of ice, which we are confident are the consequences of human greenhouse gas emissions. But some of the other ones that are often attributed to climate change in the press, we would have to be more cautious about the language that we would use there and say that they are consistent with the models. We do know for certain that some of the additional damage that is caused is from human emissions, because we know the sea level rise is from what we've done, from our greenhouse gas emissions, and that exacerbates the damage when we have these big typhoons and storm events such as Sandy as well. But we have to be careful, I think, as scientists, to make sure we never stray outside of what our science tells us. And that's problematic, I think, for many people, because they would like us to be a bit clearer sometimes about particular things that we're seeing on almost a day-to-day basis. But as scientists, we have to collect that data, and gradually over time, the anecdote becomes statistically significant, and then we can make some stronger scientifically supported statement. But we can certainly make that now about sea ice, and what we're seeing in the Arctic is a really good bellwether for the sorts of changes we're going to see around the globe. It really does indicate very significant warming has been occurring, and the scale of the impacts look to be very significant as well.
Well, look, we're seeing wave after wave of important climate science coming out these days. What are some of the papers that you think are really important?
I'm going to say here, and it's perhaps an easy one to say, but actually the latest set of IPCC reports, and I wouldn't say all of the reports, actually, one particular dimension of the IPCC report, I think, is most important. And that is that the latest set, particularly the Working Group 1, which is this main scientific report, it's captured something explicitly this science called carbon budgets. Now, implicitly, they've been in the science, well, since the science of climate change began. But the carbon budget, in other words, the total amount of carbon dioxide that we can put into the atmosphere for any particular temperature, is a really important scientific framing of the issue that gives us a much better handle for understanding what we have to do in terms of policy. So it removes a lot of the wiggle room that's been deliberately used and abused by policymakers, and actually says we have a certain carbon budget, a certain amount of carbon dioxide that we can emit for the temperature that we have politically decided we must not go above, which is, for instance, the 2°C temperature threshold. And the IPCC report gives us very clear carbon budgets with probabilities associated with them, and they should become very useful in us assessing the viability or otherwise of different policies that governments are putting forward. So I think that's probably the most important change we've seen, in that it provides a scientific basis at last for us to assess policymakers' recommendations. Another paper I think I would put alongside that, and it's by colleagues of mine, not within the Tyndall Centre, but elsewhere in the UK, is a paper by Christoph McGlade and Paul Eakins. Now, I have some disagreements with some of their conclusions, but overall what they're showing is that given the carbon budgets that we have, then we are going to have to keep most of the conventional fossil fuels in the ground. That means we cannot really be exploiting additional unconventional fossil fuels, such as the tar sands, coal bed methane, or indeed probably most of the shale gas around the globe, that would probably have to stay within the ground. So that's a really important piece of work. So in showing that if we want to abide by the commitments that policymakers have made, that civil society, that we have all agreed to, then we cannot burn anything like our current levels of fossil fuels, let alone try to pursue any more. The reason I have some small disagreement with their paper is that they did embed a significant amount of negative emission technologies, geoengineering, if you like, within their analysis. And I think that even their work, which is really quite strident and really pushing how much of the fossil fuels you have to keep in the ground, I still think that is too optimistic, because I'm more pessimistic about the likely success of geoengineering technologies in the future.
Right. Well, that's a worry that several parties have raised, that the lower pathways or warming scenarios presented by the IPCC also seem to assume a technology for removing CO2 will be found and implemented by 2100. Is that true? Did they assume that? And with no such technology available, is that a reasonable assumption?
Well, this is something I've been doing some significant work on with other colleagues of mine in the Tyndall Center, and very clearly, the wealth of low-carbon scenarios that have been generated around the globe, so low-carbon futures, trying to think about what the future might look like, virtually all of those, with the very occasional exception, does assume that these geoengineering technologies will work. And they almost always assume negative emission technologies, and they almost always assume within that something called BECCS, which is we grow bioenergy, and then we use that in power stations, and then we capture the carbon dioxide from this energy, and then we put that underground. And that they say that this effectively sucks the CO2 out of the atmosphere. The problem, of course, is partly there, is that we need the ground for growing food for a growing population. We also need the ground for making biofuels. So the aviation industry thinks it's going to use that, the shipping industry, the car industry, the cement industry, and we're going to use it for sucking CO2 out the ground, and we're going to feed 9 billion people. And unless you've got an additional planet, it does appear that there are far too many pressures being put on the land around our globe in these future scenarios. So I think that they are misleading in a lot of the scenarios, because they all have it in, rather than say one or two out of every 10. And they all assume it's going to work, and they always assume that it will fit nice and successfully into these sort of modeled futures. I think that is misleading. Every single, as I understand it, all of the new scenarios that have been used by the IPCC, they've given the acronym RCPs, Representation Concentration Pathways, Representative Concentration Pathways. These new scenarios all assume negative emission technologies, geoengineering in them. And I think that is very misleading. And I've been saying that for probably 5 or 6 years at least. And I know quite a lot of scientists are genuinely concerned about how come they are being assumed to work when we simply do not know if that will be the case or not.
Kevin Anderson, how do you feel about solar radiation management, the geoengineering technique to cool the world?
This is a very contentious issue, and to me, probably a very simple analogy is it's a little bit like having gangrene, and then in the early stages, you start putting a plaster over the part that's infected. But of course, it's going to carry on underneath that, and ultimately, you're going to suffer the consequences. And I see solar radiation management being a little bit like that. It may well be that in some niche places, it might be helpful in the future if it could work. But the idea that we can somehow reflect the sunlight back into space through one mechanism or another, that we can do that reliably over many, many decades, I think is actually, well, it's problematic from a technical point of view, but also from a governance point of view. Can you get global governance to agree with that? Which parts of the world do we protect and which parts do we not protect? At the same time, it gives policymakers, it gives the public, it gives all of us an excuse to say, let's not bother reducing our emissions because we can reflect the sunlight to compensate for the additional heat from the carbon dioxide. And therefore, the carbon dioxide levels go up in the atmosphere. That means if ever at some point there's some, say, tension around the globe, there'll be some military tension, we may no longer be keeping up this solar radiation management, which would mean we would see quite a quick, steep increase in the temperature because the carbon dioxide would have been emitted. It also does not stop acidification of the oceans, which is a growing concern. That means that the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere will be absorbed into the surface oceans. And we already are seeing a change in the pH, the acidity of the surface oceans, which affects the food balance of those oceans. So I think it's a dangerous technique in many respects. Firstly, technically, I think it will be challenging to do reliably in the appropriate areas. Second, I think it's going to be really challenging in terms of governance. And third, it is a huge distraction from actually removing the carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. That's not to say we shouldn't do some research on it, but we have to be very careful to be doing that research with assumption, the underpinning assumption that it does not work. Now, if it does work in the future, maybe we can try and have to use it then. But I think if we are planning the future with the assumption that it works, that is very misguided and very dangerous. So my personal view is we have to be very, very careful with solar radiation management, because it is only really a sticking plaster to a much more fundamental problem.
Many of us, as you know, were disappointed with the Copenhagen climate talks in 2009. Should we expect much from the Paris climate talks at the end of 2015?
I think we will see something that will be interpreted as more successful than Copenhagen. Whether in reality, in terms of climate change, it will mean anything substantial or not, I think it's very uncertain. All is to play for in Paris. So if someone asked me, to put money on Paris, I think it will fail in terms of putting in the right mechanism to bring about the scale of change in reducing our emissions that we actually need to avoid dangerous climate change. I think we will fail, but that's still up there for us to fight for. Paris 2015 is in December, so we have the rest of this year to make sure our message gets across, to get the public more involved, businesses more involved, to make us realize how serious this issue is. And there's a small chance that Paris could come up with something that is worthwhile. So all is to play for. I think the chances are slim, but I think it's a really important opportunity. And if we do not push hard, we will rue the day when we have not tried to bring about at least some much better global agreement, understanding of the challenge of the situation, and start to put pressure from that on the different nations, on the policymakers, on all of us, to actually make the real changes that the science is making very clear. We have to make those sorts of changes, those sorts of levels of reductions. To date, all we really have heard on climate change has been rhetoric. No nation has really shown any leadership in line with what would be necessary to meet the commitments that we've signed up to internationally. So we have had pretty much a quarter of a century of abject failure on climate change. Our emissions today are 60% higher than they were in 1990 at the time of the first IPCC report. Our growth rate in emissions has increased very significantly. This year looks like it might actually be, hopefully, the start of some change, but it's just 1 year's data at the moment that suggests that emissions from energy may have stabilized, may have peaked, but my feeling is that it's probably just a 1 year signal and we will go back to growth next year. Let's hope not. But we have everything to play for in Paris. If we fail, then we are effectively failing to take care and concern for our own children's future.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking with the well-known climate scientist from the UK, Kevin Anderson, at the University of Manchester. What are your thoughts, Kevin, about developments in the Arctic? Are you concerned about potential methane releases there, permafrost melting, Arctic drilling, or what?
Well, in terms of the additional methane emissions from the Arctic and from the permafrost and so forth, then these are really important areas that we need to understand much better than we do now. What we know for certain is that this is happening. It is likely to almost certainly the case that it's happening because of the additional warming we're seeing. The actual impact, the amount of gases, of greenhouse gases, particularly methane, that we're going to see released, and that is quite hard to evaluate. My colleagues who work on these particular sets of feedback mechanisms are concerned about them, but the ones that I work most closely with would say that they do not completely negate the benefits of all the other changes that we can make. So they would mean effectively that our carbon budget was significantly smaller than it already is. So in terms of what we have to do, the more carbon and the more methane that is emitted from the Arctic in this way, then that's the less carbon dioxide we can emit from our energy systems, from our food systems, and from our industrial processes. So it has big implications for what we would have to do in terms of stabilizing at a safe climate level. Beyond that, the other point is about things like the drilling in the Arctic. I mean, I think, the irony here that we are losing the Arctic because of our profligate use of fossil fuels and knowing use. We have been using it knowingly, knowing that it's going to affect the climate for 25 years. And now we're almost celebrating that we're losing the Arctic, which will give us access to additional mineral rights, additional oil exploration, and possibly shorter sea passages for ships to make goods even cheaper than they are now. So there are a whole set of reasons why I have concern about what's happening in the Northern Hemisphere in the Arctic, which relate from the releases of methane from the permafrost and so forth, through to our direct exploitation of the impacts of climate change in that region, from, for instance, the reduction in the amount of ice and therefore our opportunity to go in there and drill for more oil. There seems to be something almost quite sad that we as a species cannot see the irony in that, or that at least that our desire for more hydrocarbons outweighs our concern for the future, and again for future generations, for our own future and the future of our own children and those elsewhere in the world that live in more vulnerable communities.
For myself, it seems like we're like heroin addicts. We love that oil and we'll do anything to get it, even though we know it may be killing us and other species. I wanted to ask you, do you agree with Dr. Jennifer Francis that changes in the Arctic have altered the jet stream?
I have to say on this, I mean, this is the sort of thing where we have to be quite careful as scientists. That is not my particular area of expertise. I'm aware that other people have discussed this. The actual jet stream, again, is something, is a very complex phenomena of our climate. And that this is where there's ongoing science in these areas. But certainly, I've heard from experts I know in the area in the UK and elsewhere have been talking about adjustments to the jet stream from human-induced anthropogenic climate change for several years now. So it is a serious issue. That's the sort of scale of change that we are bringing about, where our emissions from simply driving our cars, putting our lights on, from just living the lives that we lead, are sufficient in only a few decades to be starting to have impacts at the jet stream level. You know, fundamental changes to our climate have been brought about by really not much more than 50 years of emissions, because really it's only been the last 50 or so years where we've put very large quantities of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So I share her concern about what we're seeing at these very large climatic scale adjustments that are likely or appear to be related to the additional warming from our greenhouse gases.
Do you have any guesses as to how long it will be before climate change pushes things like heat waves, drought, or storms strong enough to really threaten the world food supply?
Well, I think that's already happening, but it happens to poor people in vulnerable parts of the community that are a long way from where the media are, that are a long way from the people who, like me, who are the significant emitters. So I think that those things are already happening to people, but they're, because they're culturally removed and geographically removed and poor, we broadly have not shown any concern about them other than a little bit rhetorical language. So I think those things are occurring. They will start to occur significantly more as the temperature keeps going up and the changing the climate, changing water patterns. And we already start to see some adjustments to food availability around the world in the terms of prices, for instance. That they're triggered both by adjustments to the climate around the globe, but they're also triggered to a certain extent by our response to emissions by increased use of, say, palm oil or other biomass, which we're now using rather for sometimes necessarily for food, we're using it for energy. So, and that's also then pushing up food prices. So what we're starting to see is both from an impacts point of view and from trying to do something about it in terms of using more bioenergy, that those two together are both putting additional pressures on the food system, which is one of the reasons I raised my concern earlier, that if you add geoengineering to that, which at the moment is to use even more land for growing bioenergy, which we can then use to suck the CO2 out of the air with, that you ally these all, put these all together, and I start to see that a very challenging future, particularly for those people who do not have the wherewithal to be able to buy the food as the prices start to go up. So we have seen already in the world, people suffering from significant increases in food prices. So I don't like the idea of thinking this is the problem for the future. It's a problem for today. Unfortunately, it's not affecting those of us who are the high emitters at the moment.
As you've noticed, there's been a series of scientific papers in just the last few weeks forming a chorus of reasons why we may experience a jump in warming within this decade. Have you heard that, and would you agree?
This is the ongoing process of science. There seems the arguments that are being put forward do have some very strong scientific basis. They appear to be appropriate sets of arguments. And it is a natural process of science that we go through these things. The papers are put out there, they're reviewed, they're thought about, other people do additional research around it. And at the moment, it does appear that that's a reasonable case to make. I think we have to be quite careful in again saying that's definitely going to occur. There's certainly some evidence, strong evidence, to suggest that various levels of warming have been masked by things that we are starting to understand much better than we understood before. Nevertheless, I think we have to be quite cautious in saying that we're going to suddenly see a big leap in the rate of warming over the next few years, because there'll be some additional changes in the way the climate works and the way that El Niño works and so forth. So these are more reasons to be cautious. So I think if we were prudent, if we took the view of a precautionary approach to the welfare of our planet, then these are really important papers that should tell us that we need to be careful, and even more careful, in what it is we're doing. I think we also, though, as scientists, we have to be very careful in not pushing too far and saying that this is very clear evidence that, that this will be the case. I think at the moment the jury is still out, but the scientific consensus, I would say, is leaning towards the idea that we will likely see an increase in the rates of warming, and that the papers and the science that we have is probably adequately understanding that. But we have some way to go, I think, on that scientific understanding yet.
Now, the worst case scenario put out by the IPCC is 8.5 degrees C of warming over pre-industrial times by the year 2100. I've heard that's the path we're on now if we don't change anything. Do you think our civilization could survive the multiple ecological impacts of a warming of 8.5 degrees C over an 85-year period?
Well, I think that that's I think that's a slight misunderstanding of what the RCP, what the scenarios in the IPCC are saying. The highest scenario they have, which is called they've all got very awkward names, RCP 8.5, does not relate directly to temperature. It relates to something else, which is another measure of the level of warming, but not, it is not temperature. If you look at the highest scenario they're considering, the temperature rise is up to sort of about 5 to 6 degrees C by the end of the century. Although it's called RCP 8.5, the temperature it looks at by the end of the century is sort of the 5 to 6 degrees C temperature rise. Now, okay, that's not 8.5, but that is still an incredible increase in temperature over an almost instant in terms of any sort of way that ecosystems can respond or possibly even societies respond. This is almost an instant shock, but in as little as a couple of generations, we are seeing temperatures rising by that sort of level. We have never had that during human civilization. We've never had it. Well, we haven't seen those sorts of temperature rises for many, many millions of years. So we are putting in place an experiment to levels that our own understanding of that sort of future is limited. What we do know, what we do understand, suggests that almost at every level, from our physical infrastructure, the way that our societies are relatively stable, from things like military tension in terms of access to resources, from the collapse of a lot of ecosystems that we survive with, that we rely on, from everything from pollination of bees to access to food in the oceans, to all of these systems that are fundamental for how we and the rest of the planet survives and works in reasonable balance, that these are all being very significantly threatened by our current pathway. So I have, and again, this is anecdotal, but I have spoken to scientists for probably 10 to 15 years on about this, about a higher temperature future. And I was used to talk about 4, possibly 5 degrees temperature rise future by the end of the century. And I have not come across any scientists who do not see that as incredibly worrying, and that it's probably beyond what we can adapt to. It is beyond what most ecosystems can deal with. So it's a world that we have to avoid at all costs. So we are currently on that path towards a really very devastating future.
Well, this is all rather frightening. Can you see a way for society to reorganize to keep the temperature at some sort of safe level that we can deal with, or is it already too late for that?
It's already too late for many vulnerable people in some of the parts of the Southern Hemisphere. So we have to be blunt about this, that we have already removed the opportunities of good quality of lives for many people in the Southern Hemisphere. In fact, you know, we're making their lives, we will be devastating their lives and their incomes and their families and so forth. That is already ongoing, and that is going to get worse because we have not cared enough to reduce our emissions. I think there are many things that we can do technically, socially, behaviorally, politically, all of which would make economic sense in the traditional form of economics, which is about, you know, stewardship of how we look after our own lives, our resources, our well-being in our country and so forth. All of that fits together to make a much lower carbon future. We have not chosen to do any of that at the moment at every level, whether it's the technologies, whether it's the behavior, and whether it's our politics. At every level, we have been found wanting. We have not put the time and effort and diligence into moving towards a low carbon future. I think it is possible. I think we could, most of us around the globe would benefit very significantly from those changes, even in the relatively short to medium term. At the moment, we collectively, it's not just the policymakers, it's all of us in civil society, need to some extent hang our heads in shame when we really think about our own children and future generations, because we know what we are handing them. We know we are bequeathing them this appalling future, and we are not prepared to make changes and adjustments to our own lives, our own societies, our own countries, our own businesses. So at the moment, the signs are not looking good that we will be able to avoid very dangerous climate change. But we have all the opportunities there to do so. And that is the role of people like myself, scientists and other people, civil society, communities, NGOs and businesses, anyone who's interested in climate change, to drive the agenda in a more positive way than it has been driven so far. But the way we are going now, which is just lots of hot air and discussion around climate change, will mean that we will simply be creeping our children an appalling future.
We have been speaking with Dr. Kevin Anderson, Professor of Energy and Climate Change at the University of Manchester in the UK and Deputy Director of the Tyndall Centre. Find links to what we've discussed in my weekly Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info. Kevin Anderson, thank you so much for spending your time with us.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.